doesn't generate our motivation. And think of our fortune in being able to listen to discussion of the Bodhisattva vows, Bodhisattva precepts, so we can learn what the behavior of Bodhisattvas is. And by learning how Bodhisattvas think and speak and act, then it's clear in our own mind how to think and speak and act, what to practice and what to abandon. And so doing this will enable us to progress through the stages and accumulate the causes and conditions to actualize our spiritual aspiration, to be of the greatest benefit to all living beings through attaining the enlightened state of the Buddha. Have you been thinking about the ones we've gone over so far?
A little bit.
Yeah. How about other people? Yeah. Has it been helpful?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think that the main part I'm seeing is that when you teach about the self-liberation, it's so much more about the body and the speech, but here it's so much more about what the state of your mind and motivation is. I'm starting to connect how much more subtle that is and how much more
right. Right. Yeah. So you're being able to see how these differ from the individual liberation precepts in that they're really emphasizing actions of the mind, you know, whereas the other ones are emphasizing body and speech. And also how much more detailed these are in terms of highlighting specific actions. We can look through some of them and another interesting exercise to do is to look through these actions and say, do they fit in any of the 10 non-virtuous pathways? Yeah, and if so, which ones? Because the 10 non-virtues are like kind of the umbrella categories, and then we can look at these and we'll, you know, do these fit in one or the other of them? And if so, which one? And why is this particular instance of that particular one of the 10 non-virtues emphasized? Yeah. And what really strikes me looking at the Bodhisattva precepts is you can see that they're designed for somebody who is not a beginning practitioner. Yeah, because a beginning practitioner is going to be with the general actions of the five lay precepts, you know, and then you get more technical into, you know, those five or into the 10 non-virtues when you look at the monastic precepts. But here when you look at these, you know, praising yourself and belittling others out of attachment to honors and offering, is a new practitioner going to do that? Probably not, because they don't really know enough to be able to praise their own good qualities. Yeah. And they may not be so jealous of other people who get things because they realize they're beginners. Yeah. But it's very interesting. Once as you stop being a beginning Dharma practitioner. Sometimes your mind can more easily create certain negativities than it did when you were beginning. You know, because when you're beginning, you don't get arrogant about things. Yeah, you're just eager to learn and soak it all up. When you know a little bit, that's when the arrogance and conceit comes, isn't it? Oh, look how much I know. You know, that beginning person doesn't know. You know, I'm so great. Yeah. So you get a whole new kind of way that afflictions can arise in your mind once you've been around the Dharma a little bit. Okay? So similar with the second one, you're not giving material aid or giving the Dharma. Yeah? Well, material aid, okay, you know, that's something that may apply to everybody. But a beginning practitioner isn't going to be encountered with that because they don't know enough Dharma to give. It's only somebody who's seasoned, who's been around a while, who's going to say, yeah, I don't really like this person, or I don't want them to know the Dharma because then they'll compete with me. Something like that. Okay? And so some of these other ones, too, when we're looking at, we're going to get into, you know, denigrating the hearer's vehicle or causing people to, you know, leave their individual liberation precepts or, you know, denigrating the one we've covered already, you know, saying that the Mahayana isn't the Buddha's teaching. Is a new person going to do that one? No, they don't know Mahayana, fundamental vehicle. They don't know all of that. That's going to be somebody who's been around for a while. Okay. Who's going to denigrate the hearer's vehicle? Is that a new person? No, they don't know enough. Yeah. Somebody who's been around a while. Yeah. Who's going to take the robes from a monastic or give them, you know, like not treat them properly even if they've broken their discipline? Is that a new person? No, it's going to be somebody who has some power because they've been around a lot. Okay? So it's very interesting to go through these precepts as we cover them. And say, who is it who's likely to be involved in this kind of behavior? Yeah. Because then we may see how one day we may be in that position where, oh, you know, we're exactly the kind of person who's going to, you know, be in a position to do this kind of action. Okay? So it's quite interesting because it gives you a whole new perspective that sometimes when you know a little bit, you have to be even more careful when you don't know very much than when you don't know very much. Yeah? Because the arrogance can come more easily, the jealousy, the attachment, the anger. Yeah? The clinging to my position in the community, my reputation in the Buddhist world, you know. I want, you know, material possessions, or I want to damage the Sangha. I want to damage specific monastics. You know, these are things that it's people who are very involved in Buddhism are going to do. Yeah. No. Okay, the Beijing government, like we were saying before, you know, they could destroy monasteries and things like that. But they don't have the precept. Yeah. So who's going to have the precept who could be, you know, stealing from the three jewels? Yeah. Well, could be the caretaker of the altar. Couldn't it? Yeah. Or it could be somebody who's really trusted in the community who thinks, well, nobody will suspect me of taking this, that, or the other thing from the altar. You know, something that was offered to the Buddha Dharma Sangha. Okay? So it's very interesting to think about these things.
Mm-hmm. There are also kings who were practitioners.
Yes.
And nowadays more and more people who are directly influenced are practitioners too. So
mm-hmm.
It has a meaning for nowadays.
Yeah, yeah, it's a very good point that in ancient times there were many kings who were Buddhists. And you can see that some of these things are actions that somebody with a lot of worldly power could carry out against the Sangha. Yeah. And nowadays, you know, we do have people who have some worldly position who are Dharma practitioners. I don't know if they have as much power as the kings of the past, but, you know, still when you have worldly power, then it's very easy to do things that damage practitioners. And you can see as we go through this, a lot of it has to do with taking in one way or another the material things that belong to the Triple Gem or that are needed by practitioners in order to do their practice. Yeah, we're coming up on one where, you know, you don't steal directly, but you kind of cause the whole situation to happen, you know, with the intention of harming somebody who is practicing. Yeah. So it's going to be somebody with some kind of power who, you know, has those bad feelings. It's not going to be somebody, you know, totally unrelated to the Dharma. You know, because those people wouldn't have the precepts, even though they may do some of the actions like them. Okay? Okay. So here we are on number 9. Okay, so from Shantideva. So it's holding false views or holding distorted views. So the 9th transgression is holding wrong views. Let us examine the object first. Here the expression wrong or false views refers notably to the opinion. Okay, here he's delineating what kind of things. Yeah, the opinion that enlightened beings, karma and its effects, okay, the connection between our actions and our experience, and rebirth, past and future lives, do not exist. The action is holding these views even when we know full well that these things do exist. Now, okay, first of all, when he says knowing full well that these things do exist, I think if you knew full well, you wouldn't be holding these wrong views. So I don't know why that sentence is in there. I don't understand that. Okay, but here referring specifically to saying, for example, enlightened beings or the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha don't exist. Yeah, or karma and the law of karma and its effects doesn't exist. In other words, there's no ethical dimension to our actions. Do whatever you want as long as nobody finds out. Yeah. And that past and future lives doesn't exist. So, like I was saying before, this isn't just having doubt or having it on the back burner or something like that. This is holding a very rigid, stubborn, close-minded, you know, view that's kind of like, well, let's see if you can make me believe in that. Okay? So, you know, it's that kind of, and along that line is, for example, you know, a subsidiary would be saying it's impossible to get enlightened. Yeah? Not only do Buddha, Dharma, Sangha not exist, but there's no way to get enlightened. There's no path to enlightenment. You know, people are inherently selfish, so there's nothing to do about it. This is all stuff made up just to make people be good. Yeah, they want to threaten people with karma to make them be good. You know, these kinds of things. And you hear people say this all the time. Yeah. But so then you have to think, well, why is this damaging? Because this is also one of the 10 non-virtues. It's the 10th of the 10 non-virtues. So why is this one damaging? Yeah, it's a free world. Why can't people just believe what they want? What's wrong with thinking that Buddha, Dharma, Sangha don't exist and karma's effects don't exist and rebirth doesn't exist and just saying that's all a bunch of rubbish? Yeah, you won't get enlightened. Why?
Because you inherit something that is
Okay, so if you don't think there's enlightened beings, then you don't think there's a path to get there. So you're not going to embark on that path. Yeah, so that's something damaging to yourself and then indirectly to others. Okay? What about, yeah?
According to Papa Bao, you're supposed to be becoming awakened to the benefit of all thinking beings. Kind of throwing that out the window.
Yeah, it throws your bodhicitta out the window, doesn't it? You think that there's no such thing as full awakening, then, you know, how are you going to have bodhicitta? Yeah, what else?
It makes the possibility to do negative actions really easy.
Yeah, it makes it very easy to do negative actions because we don't consider the consequences of our actions very much. Okay. Now somebody's going to say, but do we need to really believe in future lives to realize there's an ethical dimension to our actions? You know, doesn't that sound a little bit like what we learned in Sunday school, that, you know, you don't get punished now, you get punished in your, you know, by going to hell afterwards? Isn't it an awful light like that? And wasn't that just invented to teach people, you know, all these kind of shepherds and goat herds, you know, to be nice? But, you know, we're sophisticated 21st century intelligent people. We don't need to be made afraid in order to know, you know, not to do negative things.
You wouldn't understand that looking at the world.
You wouldn't understand that looking at the world? Why?
Because they haven't figured out that you don't need a threat of an effect to be good. People are being bad.
Yeah. Okay. So you're saying people nowadays, you know, many of them don't consider the effects of their actions, even in this lifetime, and just have a very reckless attitude of, well, whatever, or as long as I, you know, they don't find out about it. Yeah, right. People get impatient, you know. Why do I have to wait to become enlightened? I want something quick. Yeah. But I think this whole thing about looking at the results of our actions is a real key thing. Now, so I remember one of the inmates that I read to for quite a long time, one of his big realizations when he was incarcerated was, the decisions I made in my life are what got me to being incarcerated. You know, he spent a good deal of time at first being quite angry at other people. You know, because when you're first busted for whatever, it's always somebody else's fault. You know, we know that, and we haven't even been arrested for anything. You know, or, well, maybe we have, but, yeah, but even if it's not something you would be arrested for, we always say it's somebody else's fault, you know. But then when you sit in prison for a while, you're going, you know, well, how did I get here anyway? And he wrote me this long letter and really kind of traced certain conditions that he came in contact with as a child and his decisions on how to act in those circumstances. And how those decisions led him to be in other situations in which he made other decisions, and that led him to be in other situations where he made other decisions, and so on and so on. And he could trace exactly how he got into prison, you know. And this was a big aha thing of, oh, my actions have results. Yeah. And yet so many of us in our life don't think of the results of our actions. You know, even in this lifetime, we don't think, if I do this, what's the good result going to be in this lifetime, let alone think about what's the result going to be in future lifetimes. Yeah? But cause and effect exists. I mean, it exists on a physical plane. Everybody, you know, knows that. Yeah, and I mean, why do people go to work? Because they want to make money. There's a cause, there's an effect. Okay, So people believe in certain kinds of causes and effects. Yeah. But at a certain point, we just kind of go into outer space and say, well, these actions, you know, don't lead to any kind of effects. They just disappear, you know. And as long as you don't get caught, you know, then it doesn't really matter. As long as nobody knows about it, it doesn't really matter. Yeah. And what I find so interesting is you see that anybody who enters politics nowadays, you know, their whole past gets investigated and all this stuff gets dredged up, you know. But at the time they did those actions, yeah, did they ever think, oh, I might be running for political office and this is going to be dredged up? No, nobody thought like that. They just thought, why not, you know? I can get some benefit from doing this, that, or the other thing. It doesn't really matter. And then years later, all of it gets dredged up. Yeah? And then they're very busy, you know, talking this, talking that, trying to explain their things, and doing everything except saying, I made a mistake. Yeah? Yeah. They won't say, I made a mistake. And they say, go as far as, I'm sorry that happened. Not, I made a mistake. So interesting, isn't it? Okay, so these wrong kind of views, you know, that can really, when we're not careful, take us down quite a slippery slope. And get us into all sorts of strange situations. I don't understand. If somebody says that the Buddha wasn't already enlightened when he was born, but actually practiced in this life and attained enlightenment.
No, he's not. He's saying, I was thinking especially of one person, but Modi is saying that he was not teaching about karma, rebirth, and so on, because he didn't want to do philosophy. He wanted more to be a practitioner, to teach the people more. I don't know, in the healing way of practicing. He was more a therapist, something like this.
So some teacher was saying that he's like a therapist.
Yeah, like Buddha is like was like a therapist.
Okay, the Buddha was like a therapist.
Yes. So, he's reflecting all his teachings of karma.
I see. So somebody who's not teaching all of the Buddha Dharma, but just let's say what the Buddha is saying about emotions, but not teaching about karma and rebirth and those kinds of things. Okay, he's neglecting that the Buddha taught about that. Okay, so that would fall under one of the earlier ones, wouldn't it? Of saying, you know, abandoning the Dharma by saying that the Buddha didn't teach certain things. Yeah?
No, but I think he started with saying that would be damaging also for the Dharma.
Yes.
The wrong views.
Oh, yeah. Oh, for sure. So if somebody has wrong views and they're in a position of giving Dharma talks and they're espousing their wrong views, then that can be very, very bad for the Dharma. Yeah.
So this is 10.9.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, point nine is if you have wrong views, you don't even have to tell anybody. You don't have to teach them. You just have to have them. Okay? But you can see that doing so is damaging for oneself as an individual. And then if you're in a position where you teach that to others, it's even more damaging. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So there's some things that, you know, it takes us a while to really develop some confidence in, but that doesn't mean we have wrong views about them. Okay. So especially about rebirth, you know. Rebirth, I certainly didn't grow up with that idea. Yeah, it wasn't a kind of an automatic part of my cultural, you know, background and the assumptions that I grew up with. So getting used to the idea of rebirth, yeah, is one thing, but saying, oh, this is a, you know, it absolutely is a bunch of nonsense is another thing. Okay, so here we're talking about somebody who really has a very stubborn wrong view. Okay? Generally speaking, a false view can either be an assertion that something exists when it does not. Okay? Yeah, like inherent existence exists, even though it doesn't. Yeah. Or the denial of something that does exist, like karma and its effects doesn't exist. However, this transgression involves only the latter, which is far more serious than the former. Although I would think it would depend on different things in the former. I mean, if you start saying, you know, the Buddha is some creator being, or there's an inherently existent state of enlightenment that, you know, that we're all part of, or, you know, there's a cosmic mind we're all going to dissolve back into. I think that's also quite damaging to people. Okay. The nature of the major transgression of holding false view is identical to one of the ten non-virtues, the last of the three harmful mental karmic paths. Committing the ninth major transgression does not require making others share our opinions, nor the presence of the four binding factors. Is that necessary? In fact, we annihilate our virtue and lose our bodhisattva vows as soon as we entertain one of the above mentioned wrong views. So it's just having that, and here entertain doesn't just mean a light kind of thinking. It's you know, deep in your mind. And so you can see you don't have to say anything. You don't need the four binding factors, which we'll come to. It's just thinking in this way. Yeah. So it can be quite dangerous. Yeah. Okay. The number 10 is, Shantideva says, and destroying places and so forth. So the 10th major misdeed involves destroying places. The object, places, includes villages, towns, regions, and provinces, but not the people living in them. The motivation is the intention to destroy a place provoked by klesha, by afflictions. There is no desire to steal, for example, but simply to destroy. Okay. The action is demolishing by any means. This brings war to mind. Although in a war it happens that places are wrecked, this is not usually the main objective. Yeah, because in a war, usually you want to harm the people. Yeah, the place is secondary. But here, the specific aim is to ruin a place. A relevant example would be arson, purposely setting fire to the house of someone we don't like. Okay. Of course, there the person could be inside, so you want to harm them too. But this is specifically, you know, you don't want to necessarily harm the person. You don't want to steal the possessions. You just want to destroy the habitat where somebody lives. Okay? Not raising a town but killing or wounding its inhabitants could be the third major transgression, striking others out of anger, but not this one, the tenth. If we confiscate people's property, the fault is of yet another nature. Okay? Is more, you know, you're stealing, okay? It may be the fifth, taking that which belongs to the three jewels, or the 16th, inflicting fines on ordained persons and accepting what has been offered or what was intended to be offered to the three jewels. But in any case, it is not the present fault. Okay? Some transgressions are called king's transgressions and others minister's transgressions because people in positions of power are most likely to commit them. Following Shantideva's list of downfalls, the first five that he talked about, in other words, number 6 through 10, are said to be the king's transgressions because the kings have the power to, you know, to do this. And the present one, a minister's transgression. So be 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Yeah, 5 to 9 would be the kings in this one, the ministers. But it seems to me a king could do this one too. In any case. Yeah. Okay, anything about that one? Yeah. Well, here it's specifically, you know, talking about human habitats. Yeah, because I've often thought about that because sometimes we have to, you know, we relocated the ants and so on. So, you know, but here it's specifying specifically human habitats, just wanting to destroy. Okay. Mm-hmm. I mean, people can have all sorts of motivations, you know. You're jealous of somebody. Somebody else has a very nice monastery or a very nice house, and you're jealous and you want to destroy it. Yeah. Yeah, he was...
separating the people
out. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because the most important thing somebody possesses is their life. Yeah. So that's the killing precept. And then the second thing, you know, in order to stay alive, you need certain material things. So if somebody is destroying those material things, especially the place where you live, so that you have no home to go back to and you're exposed to the elements, you know, and all your wealth is taken away and now you're just trying to get your life put back together. Yeah. Uh-huh.
So I'm just sitting here struggling with one after the other.
Uh-huh. Right.
That's where I have trouble thinking. Like someone who's gone to the level of taking the Bodhisattva vow, and then they go destroy a town. It's like, I'm just having trouble.
Yeah, okay. So it seems funny, you know. Okay, here's somebody who's gotten to the level where they're taking the Bodhisattva vow, which means they have some kind of intention for enlightenment. And then they would go out and destroy a town or, you know, set fire to somebody's house or whatever. You know. Yeah. Well, the thing is, if you look around, you know, I mean, we've taken the Bodhisattva vow. Do we always have virtuous minds? The things seem extreme. Well, I think that's one of the reasons why they are root infractions. Because to commit a root infraction, your mind really has to be in a state where you're really, really overwhelmed by negativities to get yourself to the point where you would do something like this.
And are these like
No. Remember, I said at the beginning that these are things that were found throughout the Mahayana Sutras that Asanga and then later Shantideva extracted and made into a series of Bodhisattva precepts. They didn't occur through specific situations like the precepts of individual liberation did. Okay? Yeah. But, you know, you could also see maybe there's somebody who, you know, develops psychic powers, and then they think, oh, wouldn't that be interesting? Let's see if I can destroy this, that, or the other thing at some place where people live. Yeah?
Uh-huh. I mean, to take these, it doesn't seem like you have to be some highly realized practitioner.
No.
So any ordinary person who takes these could easily fall into these kinds of problems, because we see it all the time. And there's an assumption that we shouldn't make, which is that every Buddhist is a good Buddhist.
Yeah.
It reminds me of a story that I had a professor in college, and I was in her office, and she had to go to the restroom. She started to leave and then came back and said, oh, well, no, I can leave my purse here. You're a Buddhist. And I said, yeah, but that doesn't mean I'm a Buddha or even a good Buddhist. You know, so there was this weird assumption that I wouldn't take her purse. She was right, but the reasoning wasn't very
good. Yeah.
So I think it's very reasonable to think that people could
Oh, yeah. I mean, we're always, so shocked. Sometimes people, I mean, it's even happened here. Somebody, you know, we may know somebody very, very well, and they seem to really be doing good work on the Dharma path, and they're really doing something, making a lot of progress, and then wham, they're like out in left field. Yeah, and we're so shocked. Like, how could this person who's been coming to retreats and done this and this and this go and do that? Because they're human beings, and we're under the influence of afflictions and karma. Yeah? Uh-huh.
The thing that this could happen, people, if they have power, and then they have,
Exactly. Yeah, right. That's a very good example. Yeah. People, what they do when they're getting a divorce, the person that they love so much, now so much vile hatred towards that same person. And you could never even imagine it would have happened. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Could one modern way to see is to take away from that itself, so this, not destroying, but just in that example, for example, taking away from one itself, because if it's a balance, the other one is kind of the capital, I don't have a house now.
Yeah. Well, if you take away somebody's house, that would be stealing. Yeah. Here we're talking specifically about destroying it. Okay? So that's a different state of mind. You steal it because I want it. Yeah? Yeah, I want to damage you, but, you know, I'll taunt it. I want to damage you, but the fact that I have it and you don't will really hurt you. Whereas this one's just, I want to destroy. Yeah? Yeah, so slightly different than stealing. Yeah. I mean, still could be the same motivation to harm somebody. And have, you know, some similar effects. Yeah?
Is there a motivation? Because, like, I'm thinking, like, the government wants to build a freeway. They buy a house, and they destroy the house so they can build a freeway.
Yeah.
But they've, you know, moved the people someplace else.
Yeah. Well, in that kind of thing, like a government buys something to build the freeway, you know, they've compensated the people, hopefully.
But they're still destroying that.
Yes, but that house is then their house. It no longer belongs to the other person. No, it has to be somebody else's thing, I think. You know, it's not destroying your own property. Yeah. Otherwise, when you take down a building because you want to rebuild it, yeah. No, this is intentionally destroying somebody else's property. Yeah. Because otherwise, you could never take down anything and rebuild it. Which wouldn't make much sense. Okay, so number 11, Shantideva says, explaining emptiness to unprepared beings. The 11th major transgression is incurred by teaching the profound concept of emptiness to those who are not qualified to hear it. In the words of the Succession Guru Yoga, it is teaching emptiness to people who are untrained. Now, I'm going to read the way he's described it here, but it doesn't... It isn't the way I've previously heard it explained, and also there's some points of it that seem strange, okay? So I'll go through what he wrote here, and then I'll tell you the way I've usually heard it, okay? So the object is any unfit person, in other words, anyone who is not sufficiently trained in the stages of the path to enlightenment, to understand the notion of emptiness and who is therefore in danger of being frightened by it. That part, yes, definitely. Okay? Somebody who doesn't have sufficient awareness of the Lam Rim and of conventional reality as is in great danger of misunderstanding emptiness so that they think that nothing exists. Okay? So people need to prepare themselves by training gradually in the paths shared with persons of lesser and intermediate motivations before they can tackle the topic of emptiness without risk. Okay? So that's for sure. Okay? The object is an insufficiently trained person who follows the great vehicle, aspires to realize enlightenment, and has taken the bodhisattva vows, but has yet to meditate the stages of the path to the point of realizing bodhicitta. As a result, he or she runs the risk of being profoundly troubled by the notion of emptiness. So here he's limiting the person to somebody who's a Buddhist who's taking the bodhisattva vow. And he explains why as follows, and this is the point that I have a qualm with. Okay? The action consists of rashly teaching emptiness to unsuitable people. The transgression is complete if followers of the Mahayana, okay, so he's specifically saying followers of the Mahayana, as a consequence of our explanation, misinterpret emptiness to mean that nothing exists and take fright. Then they think that achieving Buddhahood is too difficult and conclude that it would be better to give up the idea of enlightenment and seek personal liberation from samsara instead. Now that I don't understand why somebody misunderstanding emptiness would make them abandon the thought of enlightenment and seek personal liberation instead, because you have to realize the same emptiness to attain arhatship. So that's why I don't understand what he's saying here. When they then effectively abandon the Mahayana and strive for individual liberation, the transgression is accomplished, for their motivation has fallen from a superior to an intermediate level. This transgression supposes that we have not made an effort to assess the student's readiness to hear an explanation of emptiness. Okay, let me stop before we get into this part, because that the following part, I think, you know, is something that makes a lot of sense. But the way I've usually heard this one described is the person doesn't have to be somebody who is following the Mahayana and has taken the bodhisattva vow. It can be any old person, yeah, but as he's saying here, okay, the transgression supposes that we have not made an effort to assess the student's readiness to hear an explanation of emptiness. If we take the trouble to evaluate their suitability and mistakenly conclude that they are apt, even if they are shocked by the topic to the extent that they give up their aspiration to Buddhahood and follow the hearer's vehicle, the transgression is incomplete. Although we have not succeeded, we have tried our best to assess the student's abilities. Okay. When the above conditions are fulfilled, teaching emptiness to those who are unprepared constitutes a major transgression of the bodhisattva vows, despite the fact that emptiness is the ultimate mode of existence of all phenomena and that understanding it is the unique door to liberation from samsara. We must conclude, therefore, that it is not because something is true that it is necessary or even right to explain it to anyone who crosses our path. Okay? So I'm going to come back to that point. But first, the way I've always heard this explained before is it can be just any old person, yeah, but we don't check that person's capability. So it doesn't have to be someone with a bodhisattva vow or a Mahayanist. It could be Joe Blow or, you know, who just walks in off the street. But we don't assess that person's readiness to hear teachings on emptiness. And we teach them. And because emptiness is such a delicate subject, they misunderstand it, as many people do. The lower schools all misunderstand it and think that emptiness means nothing whatsoever exists. Okay? So you know, somebody comes in off the street to the Dharma Center. You teach emptiness. You know, when you look in this, you can't find a clock. When you look in here, you can't find a real cup. When you look in here, you can't find a real person yourself. And then that person gets the wrong idea. Oh, nothing whatsoever exists. If nothing whatsoever exists, then I can do anything I want because cause and effect doesn't, you know, nothing exists. So there's no effects of my actions and everything is just make-believe, you know. As long as I think that's the only thing that gives it some reality, you know. And in fact, nothing really exists. Okay? And so it's falling to that nihilistic state, which is very dangerous, because then the person is very apt to not take care with observing karma and its effects. And that's the danger for them, because then they are prone to commit a lot of negativities, because they think, well, nothing exists, so it doesn't matter what I do. Yeah? Okay? So it can be kind of anybody. Yeah? So it's really emphasizing the point that we have to assess somebody's suitability to hear a teaching. You know, that just because we know something and just because a Dharma teaching is true, that doesn't mean that it's good to tell it to everybody who we come across. Okay? And this is something to really think about, because sometimes in our enthusiasm to share the Dharma with people, we teach them the Dharma, but they're not ready to hear certain things. And they get the wrong idea, and it really turns them away from the Dharma. And here the specific instance is emptiness, because misunderstanding that leads to this nihilistic view and unethical actions. But it could be any aspect of the Dharma, you know. But we're just, you know, so over-exuberant and want to tell everybody that we're not sensitive to what exactly that person needs to hear. Yeah? Or sometimes we might be even a little bit puffed up with ourselves. You know, I call it the chai shop guru syndrome. You know? You learn a little bit of Dharma and now you're going to become the guru at the tea shop. And it happens all the time in India and Nepal. Yeah? Somebody learns a little bit of Dharma and then they sit and teach the little bit they learn, whether they understood it correctly or incorrectly, doesn't matter. But they're so full of exuberance to talk about it that they talk about it in the tea shops. And without considering, you know, do they know it well enough? Or in this instance of this precept, is it skillful to teach that to this person? Is the person going to understand things correctly and get the right idea? Okay. So it's really emphasizing this one to kind of assess people and look at their training, and especially before teaching emptiness, they always say that you teach about conventional truth first before teaching the ultimate truth. So the whole thing about conventional truth is causality. Yeah, dependent arising. So karma and its effects. And so people always have to learn that before they get teachings on emptiness. Yeah. And you see some people, it's like, I don't forget karma, it's effects. That sounds like Sunday school. I want, you know, Dzogchen Mahamudra, go into the bliss of wisdom and emptiness and lose myself there. But the people haven't understood really well about karma and its effects yet. Yeah? So it becomes confusing for them when they start to think about emptiness, because they aren't grounded enough yet in a proper understanding of just conventional functioning.
So then whatever the situation was that the UU and I skirted them, I didn't actually, I don't know if I helped them or not, but there was a couple there that had lost their son recently to a disease. They were evidently grieving. They had been ready to go to a trip to Asia with him just before they were going to go to die. And they came to the UU class, and they were really wondering how to explain it to themselves in a way of how do these things happen for a Buddhist worldview. And, you know, they were still in such a place that I didn't think I had the skill to even broach something like karma. In those situations, how would you be able to benefit them in that? Because they sincerely were asking to have some clarity and understanding to allay their grief on his loss. How would you be able to do that without jumping into something like karma?
Yeah, okay. Okay, so the situation you were in, somebody who's brand new came. They're grieving the loss of their child. They're saying, how did this happen? What's the Buddhist explanation for why it happened? And yet, you know, you don't want to get into the whole thing about karma, because, I mean, they're brand new off the street. Okay, and I'll tell you a story. Do you remember when the flight number that went down over Lockerbie? 803? Yeah. So that, the flight that went down over Lockerbie. Yeah. So it had a lot of students from a university in, was it Syracuse or Rochester? It was a Pan Am flight, remember? So I happened, this was many, many years ago. Okay. Like maybe 1989 or something. And, I happened to go to that school. And I was giving a talk, and some people were there and said, how do you, you know, they're grieving the loss of their friends, and they say, how do you explain this? And I made the mistake of talking about karma. You know? It didn't work. Yeah? And I subsequently learned when I went to a Jewish group and they said, how do you explain the Holocaust? You don't talk about karma. That's not the skillful approach. And you know what's very interesting in those situations where people are grieving is they always want to know why. But actually, that question, the answer to that question is not really going to help them. The issue is not why did it happen. That's always our instantaneous thing of why did it happen, as if understanding why would help, okay? When often understanding why doesn't help at all. No matter, you know, whether it's a situation of the why, meaning the condition, the immediate conditions, or why meaning the whole karmic thing. That the real thing that people are asking is, or the real thing they're saying is, I'm grieving. Can you say something to me that will help me alleviate my grief? Okay? They're saying, why did this happen? But really what they're saying is, can you help alleviate my grief? Okay? That's the real question. So then, I think it's much more skillful, if you tune into what their question really is to talk about how to alleviate grief, you know? And it is a tragedy, and, you know, it's the last thing you expect, and, you know, it's a shock, because even though on an intellectual level we know things are transient, you know, whenever something happens, we're always shocked because our mind is clinging to the idea of permanence, you know. And then one thing that I say to people that I think really helps is I say, when we're separated from somebody that we love, we're not mourning the past because we had the past with them. Yeah. What we're mourning is the future. Yeah. Because we had all these thoughts that that person would be in our future with us. And now it's turning out that the future we had anticipated is not going to be. So we're actually mourning something that hasn't even happened yet. Yeah, and then they go, oh yeah, you know, I'm mourning something that hasn't even happened. I'm mourning something because of my expectation. And then I say, look back in the past and think about the benefit you received from knowing that person and what you shared with that person, and rejoice that they were in your life for as long as they were. Because we know that everything is transient. We know everything's under the influence of causes and conditions, and that separation is inevitable. But rejoice for as long as that person was in your life. Wasn't that wonderful that you shared what you were able to share, and you loved each other, and you learned from each other, and so many good things happened? And so just rejoice that you had that. And then take the love and everything you gained from knowing that person or those people, take that into the future with you and share that love with other people that you meet in the future. And so that gives people who are grieving a way to think about the situation and a way to transform the loss into getting in touch with the fact that their heart can be full of love for that person, and they can take that love into the future and give it and share it with other people. Yeah? And so I find, you know, really talking to what their needs are in that situation is much more skillful and much more effective than going on a long discourse about karma and, you know, why do suffering things happen to good people? Because in the past they created negative actions. But, you know, they don't want to hear that their loved one created a negative action in the past life, you know? That's not in on their radar, okay? So it's better to talk to where they are at the present, okay?
Mm-hmm. This idea of readiness seems quite fluid. And so what you look for, and thinking of, you know, is this group ready? Is this person ready?
Yeah. Well, you know, you just look and you see kind of, you know, sometimes I'll say when I'm giving a talk, how many people are beginners, and I'll raise my own hand because I'm a beginner. You know, because otherwise people don't like to say they're beginners. Well, we all are, really. Yeah. You know, so I try and get a sense of the group. Sometimes I may ask somebody beforehand if I'm going to a specific Dharma center, you know, something about the group. Or you ask people questions. Or you start teaching something, you know, that you know everybody can take and handle and that's not going to damage them in any way, and then you see by the expressions on their face what's going on. Yeah. But I, you know, I would not go into a group I don't know and just start teaching about emptiness. Yeah, that's not appropriate. Yeah. Because it's not what, yeah, I mean, what do people need to hear at the beginning? You know, how their mind is the creation, the creator of their happiness and suffering, which is actually dealing with the topic of emptiness.
Yes.
Actually dealing with the topic of emptiness. But it doesn't run the risk of somebody misinterpreting things.
Mm-hmm. But then there's a difference between it teaching and discussing, right? Because to understand emptiness, like for example, either I'm an emptiness, I need to talk to somebody or something.
Oh, yeah. This is talking about somebody giving a teaching on emptiness. somebody explaining emptiness to somebody who's unprepared. It's not talking about having a discussion about emptiness with a Dharma friend.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're discussing something with a Dharma friend, yeah, you bring up different ideas and you go back and forth. And I mean, this is what they do at the monasteries all the time, and how you learn.
And can you do also then in the Dharma group, like say, this is not a teaching we're going to discuss about?
Well, you have to see who's in the Dharma group. If it's Joe who just walked in, he knows nothing about Buddhism. Yeah.
Does it seem like sometimes there are teachings that are publicly offered and that people can just come if they're advertised?
It seems like there's teachings that are publicly offered. Come and get this highest class Tantra initiation. You know, Friday night, it's your only opportunity. And, you know, come get it. And it's only $99.99 for you. Special price.
You have a good point. If you're giving teachings that are completely open to everybody, and then teaching about something like almost everything.
Yeah. Okay, so even His Holiness is teaching things, you know, is giving things that are open to everybody. Is His Holiness's first Dharma talk in the in the lecture series about emptiness? No. It's about bodhicitta, having a kind heart, you know, using our intelligence, using reasoning to evaluate the teachings. He doesn't start something off with emptiness. He gives people background. Yeah. And then when he does teach emptiness, very often it's at a level where the people who aren't ready to hear it are not going to understand it anyway. Yeah. Because he's saying, you know, what Nagarjuna said in this text, in this verse, and then we compare it to that verse here, and this, you know. And the newbie is going to go, huh? Okay. Yeah. But His Holiness always gives background.
Is that like the thing in Dharma Sangha where there's teachings offered and people can come at any time without having to teach it before?
There's weekly, most Dharma centers, there's weekly teachings. People can drop in. But then still, if you're teaching that class and somebody brand new drops in, you have to kind of see where you are in the text and what you're teaching. And very often, you know, if somebody does that on the emptiness section, I'll say to the person, you probably won't understand this, and da-da-da-da-da-da, and give some kind of introduction, you know, before I teach what I had in mind for the rest of the class. Okay, to make sure somebody doesn't misunderstand.
So probably one of the students can actually realize it, but just instead of abiding in the person, go back into the
student. So you're talking about a situation where a teacher is showing the nature of the mind to a student. That's probably not going to be done in a Dharma class with a lot of people around.
Well, for example, not maybe not a talk in that group, or somebody gives like an interview, but it's, and not for beginners. Maybe the people that are attending that class, are intellectually understanding emptiness. And the teacher shows the nature of the mind to them. But maybe some of them are not prepared and they're just scared and won't be able to understand.
You know, I'm not really well versed in that. I don't think I can comment on it, you know. First of all, you have to see if that teacher really is capable of showing the students the nature of the mind or not. You know? Yeah, first of all, you have to check that. Second of all, you have to check, you know, the students. And like it's saying here, if somebody checks a student well, and then it winds up that the student misunderstands. You're not breaking this precept. Yeah. I mean, this precept has to do with just not caring and giving the teaching broadly. But, you know, this whole thing about teachers showing people the nature of their mind, you know, it's talked about sometimes as if it just, you know, happens on the Dharma Center on Thursday night. Yeah, just show up and you're going to get this transmission and be shown the nature of your mind. I'm not so sure. Because, first of all, Dzogchen is an extremely high practice. You have to do a whole lot of preparation to actually be able to do Dzogchen meditation properly. You know, and I know people just walk in off the streets and are getting instruction on it. I don't know. Yeah, but if you look the way the great Dzogchen masters, Lung Chenpo and so on, you know, have taught, so much preparation, you know. And then being shown the nature of the mind, it's not just, you know, you happen to be in the group on Thursday night, and, you know, oh, I happen to be giving the nature of the mind today to, you know, 35 people who are here. It's not like that. Yeah. Yeah, to really have that happen, to have some proximity or some good experience, you know, anything can happen. Yeah, but to really have that happen is, you know, a teacher's going to know that student very, very well and will have led them from the beginning of the path. You know, because if you look where Dzogchen is, you know, in the view of the nine yanas, it's the last one. Yeah, so you have to do the first eight first. Okay? Yeah? I'm talking about to really do it. Nowadays, what a lot of teachers are doing are they're just planting seeds in people's minds. You know, we'll give you this initiation, we'll give you this thing. You probably won't understand it anyway, but it plants good seeds in your mind for future rebirth. Yeah, so that's the way a lot of things are taught now. Yeah. So, because if you look, you know, when you look at the qualifications for that kind of student, and then you say, do I have those qualifications? Yeah, that's all you have to do to understand what's happening, you know? Yeah? This teaching is for a student that has this, and is trained in this and this, and has some sense of this, and some sense of this, and some sense of the other thing. Do I have all of that? Yeah? So let's go back and create the causes. You know, it's good to plant the seeds. You know, you plant the seeds, then in a future lifetime those seeds will ripen. Okay, so good to plant the seeds. But in terms of our practice, we need to practice where we're at. Okay. Build the foundation before you build the roof. Otherwise, like we had here, the meditation hall was up in the air. Remember? We had the walls and the roof and we brought them over. But it couldn't be used because there was no foundation. Yeah. You build a good foundation, then you can have firm walls. Then when you put the roof up, it stays up and it doesn't leak. It doesn't fall down. Yeah. Okay. Yes.
And this is still on this topic, so I don't know if you mind. Yep. I actually just happened to read it. I was flipping through one of the books you got in. A book on the kind of the new Buddhism of America, and quoting from one very popular teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And I know you're supposed to be responsible to hear maybe what you really can say to this, if anything worthwhile. I just said that the Tibetan nomad But the Westerners are psychologically mature, whereas the West are known as the Tibetans, known as one, and that now the conscious ocean.
Well, you know what I'm going to say. So his question was, he was reading a book on something about the new American Buddhism or something. I haven't seen that book yet. But, yeah. And so somebody was saying that this teacher, a very popular teacher, this was what John's saying, said that that the Tibetan nomads were very unsophisticated. Whereas Westerners are very psychologically sophisticated, so they're ready for Dzogchen. So he's asking me what I think about that. And he's lived here a year and a half.
Go back on the road and become a nomad.
Yeah. I don't think I need to comment on that. For what, some reason or another, you ask a question and I don't understand your question properly, please keep asking it until I do. Okay? And then second of all, regarding that question that you asked, you know, to ask one teacher what they think of the way other teachers are guiding their students, yeah, that's not... You know, that's, yeah, you know, if you're asking a sincere question about, you know, here's this teaching, am I ready to do it? Yeah, but don't ask one person to comment about how somebody else is guiding their students, you know, because different people are attracted to different students for one reason or another reason, you know. And to ask somebody to make a general comment about what else some other teacher's doing, it's not something I know that I would want to do, because I have no idea how somebody's guiding their individual students and what they're teaching, what the background is, and this and that. You know, if you're asking about, is this something I should practice, then that's something I can respond to. Yeah. Yeah, but to say, you know, this teacher's teaching people this and that and the other thing, what do you think about it? You know? I'm thinking, where would that question be coming from? Why would we want to know, you know, what this person thinks about what that person's teaching? Why would we want to know that? Is because we're thinking of studying that teaching from that teacher, and we want to know if we should, in which case we should ask the question, here's somebody who's teaching this, I feel drawn to study it, do you recommend I do? That's the question you're really asking. Do you get what I'm saying? But you know, why do you think, you know, what do you think of so-and-so teaching this and that? What's the real question behind that? What would knowing that, you know, I mean, there's another question behind that, not the question that's being asked. At least that's what it feels like to me. Okay? So maybe it might be good to get in touch with what's the real question that you're trying to ask. When, you know, yeah, okay, yeah, because what I think about how somebody else guides their students, who cares, why is that valuable information? Does it help that student, does it help that teacher, does it help the person who's asking it, for me to comment about somebody else, how they're guiding their students when I don't really know? That, you know, that it's not for me to say, and it's not information that I think would be valuable to anybody in their practice. So I think, you know, when we think things like that, to ask ourselves, what am I really trying to ask? And then ask what we're really trying to ask. What it is we really want to know that would actually be a benefit to us in our practice. It's kind of like, and we'll come to this a little bit later, but you see in India, you know, again, you know, the chai shop gurus, people are talking about, another thing, you know, kind of what level of the path their teachers have realized. You know, this teacher's an incarnation of so-and-so, and that one's an incarnation of so. No, you got it all wrong. This one's an incarnation of this. That one's an incarnation of that. Their incarnation lineage goes back in here. And, you know, and so then the way they teach, you know, I'm sure that they've realized this level and that level and the other level. And I wonder, what use is that? What use is that? You know? You might say, well, it develops faith if you say so-and-so is the incarnation of so-and-so. So it might help develop faith a little bit. But to just say so-and-so is the incarnation of so-and-so, that itself doesn't really develop faith. You have to see how the person's acting and seeing if their actions are something that increase faith in you. Yeah, not just some title or rumor that, you know, they're this or that, or they've realized this and that. You know, you have to look at, you know, what are they teaching and how are they behaving and how do they treat people? And then the most important thing is, you know, not what level they're at and who they're the incarnation of, you know, but I'm the incarnation of somebody who just got out of the hell realm. And I have a precious human life. And I better not waste it. You know? And you're laughing, but this is true, isn't it? That's the important thing to know. I just got out of the hell realm and I have a precious human life. And it's important for me to use it wisely. It doesn't matter what level they've attained and who they're the incarnation of. You know? What matters is, you know, the teaching I'm getting, does it correspond to the general Buddhist teaching? Am I understanding that teaching correctly? How do I put that teaching into practice? That's what's important. You know? But otherwise, this, you know, all this one's a Rinpoche who was recognized at this age, and that one's this, and an incarnation is so-and-so. You know, it might help develop some faith, but, you know, sometimes all these people with these names and titles don't act in ways that develop faith, and then you get more confused. Yeah? So there's something that, well, maybe I better stop. But, you know, there's something called the four reliances, and I should talk about that, and then that really shows what's important to understand. So remind me, and I'll talk about that. Okay. It's like, you know, somebody... No, I better stop.